Hi, and welcome to Scale Ups and Downs, the podcast brought to you by Google for Startups, in which we invite startup founders to share the ups and downs, the hint is in the name, of their journey to scale. I'm your host, Marta Krupinska, head of Google for Startups in the UK. Having co-founded three startups myself and made all sorts of mistakes and survived all sorts of trials and tribulations, I know that the key to success is surrounding yourself with the right people to find solutions together. So for each episode, I'm very lucky to be joined by a panel of experts, founders, investors, industry and field specialists, so that we can jointly discuss the challenges that our guest founders are dealing with.
So this week, we'll be discussing what it means to succeed in a hugely hyped up market or industry. We've all seen the rise and sometimes fall of startups that seem to hit that perfect timing, which allowed them to go super fast and respond to the pull of the market. But what happens when the moment is over? How to stay nimble and respond well to the market need, but pair it with a sound long-term strategy? How to know where to move next if you're one of the pioneers in a new space? How do you stand out if you're building a product in a massively crowded space? And is that good or bad, in fact, that there is a lot of competition? These are just some of the questions that you might want to hear about if you're a founder in a hyped up sector. So listen on, as we have some absolutely amazing panelists and ambitious founders here to ask and have their questions answered.
So for today's episode, I'm joined by two brilliant experts, Natasha Litton, who runs Brand Network and Portfolio at one of our best and most loved European VCs, Seedcamp. Hello, Natasha. How are you?
Great, thank you. How are you doing? Very excited to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us on this rainy day. And alongside Natasha, we're joined by Devin, designer, educator, and founder of two amazing tech companies, including List, but also venture partner at Seedcamp here with Natasha. He's part of Fund 4 and 5 with a focus on pre-seed investments and supporting product and tech founders. Hello, Devin. How are you doing?
Hello, Marta. Happy to be here.
Thanks so much. So I'm so delighted to have you both representing the venture capital view, which is so important, especially for earlier stage founders, but also representing this scaled founder perspective. So Natasha, would you mind sharing a little bit more about yourself and also what's currently keeping you busy?
Yeah, happy to. I guess the thing I should probably say is before I came to this venture world, you know, 5.5 years ago, I was an operator in startups and I saw a real mix from having hyper growth and managing to become a leader in a very crowded market to the absolute opposite and having a shutdown. And the market dynamics of what was at play, trying to understand the realities of the micro, what was going on inside the company, as well as the macro impact that was influencing us, and realizing that some of that stuff could be outside of our control, how we could do our best to mitigate for that and navigate these storms within companies was a lot of actually what inspired me and made me curious to come and work on the fund side of things. And being able to work now with a huge portfolio. So at Seedcamp, we've got a portfolio of 430 companies. My focus is really on the post-investment. How do we get our founders on that track to achieve a really strong Series A and beyond, to kind of really hit velocity and speed? And that's what I'm focused on now. All of that operational experience in kind of brand and marketing and thinking about positioning and how you really creating and carving out something unique, to then more broadly thinking of what is it you need as a company to help you grow.
That's super awesome. And actually, Seedcamp is so relevant for this conversation and your experience for this conversation of hyped up industries. You guys have invested in so many companies that are widely considered iconic, from TransferWise to more recently Hopin. And I wonder, Natasha, any insights from that scale up journey of these super successful unicorn companies? When did you realize, okay, they're about to massively take off? And are there any common threads between these moments?
I think the thing to say first is we invest so early, it's really unknown. You know, it's very easy to retrofit, well, obviously that was going to be a huge success, but when we invested in Hopin, there was no COVID. And when we invested in So Rare, for example, nobody knew what an NFT really was. And similarly, when we invested in Wise, formerly TransferWise, back in 2011, nobody was operating financially and had the confidence to do that on their app. So I guess, look, a lot of what we do is have to look at trends and think about where we think there's a potential to disrupt a staid industry and what that can mean for the future. We don't necessarily always get it right. But I think to your question around what are the commonalities in these people, it's generally a founder who has such a strong belief and an unwavering belief in the problem that it is they're out to solve. That's how they take everybody on the journey with them and kind of build these really strong businesses. I think what's really unique at Seedcamp as well, if you look at our 7 unicorn businesses that we have, the founder is still the CEO. In every single one of those businesses, whether that's the kind of public companies and UiPath and, you know, Wise to the kind of WeFoxes and SoRes of this world. So yeah, I think that's pretty unique.
Really awesome. Thank you, Natasha. And Devin, you're obviously wearing multiple hats. We're so delighted to have you on the podcast, bringing all these different perspectives. What are you most excited about these days that's keeping you busy?
And that's a good question. Yeah. So just as a bit of context, like I'm wearing my two biggest hats I'm wearing right now is, you know, one half the venture partner role at Seedcamp, where I've been with, you know, I've been part of Seedcamp for a long time now and sort of providing that founder-led experience to the companies we get excited about, which sometimes is contrary to what like maybe a financial bit of knowledge would make you excited about. You know, I put a lot of stock into founders who display uncanny ambition and excitement about a space that I might find boring. So that usually means there's something very interesting going on that I need to learn more about, which is always a nice journey. And the other hat I'm wearing is I'm the founder of my fourth business now, Useful Books, which is a software stack to help indie authors publish, launch, market, monetize their own books. So really provide the traditional like pitchforks and shovels to people who don't want to go with a Penguin or Random House or even Amazon publishing. Like really, you know, we have enough technology that you should be able to handle this all by yourself. So why not do it by yourself? And so on that thread, like what really excites me now is what excited me 10 years ago, which is like building the new tools for the new stuff. Obviously, Web3 is a huge trend and crypto, but even along crypto, there's new styles of commerce, new types of media. And this is like VR, AR, biotech, stuff like that. There's a whole plethora of things that people want to do. And a lot of people are hacking together, but there's a huge opportunity to build the polished tools, you know, instead of using a hammer, you know, people building like the perfect sledgehammer for breaking concrete, like that opportunity still exists. So the investments you made at Seedcamp recently, I think, really mirror this trend. Things like Live Blocks and GDevelop and things like that. It's amazing how much space there is to make things better, to allow the creators and the builders and the founders to do even bigger things. So that's what I like to look at.
That's so awesome. And that makes perfect sense. And you answered this so brilliantly that I'm tempted to ask a follow-up question. Obviously, the subject of this podcast is scale ups and downs. And you've built a lot. Any particular nuggets of insight from that cusp of scale that you share with founders that you work with these days?
I mean, I say this almost all the time, and Natasha can back me up on this because it's sort of what I've become famous for and like in the deal room at Seedcamp is like having the customer voice when you're building stuff is so important. My first business habit was, I'd like to think a technological marvel that no one ever used because we never spent time looking for the people who actually needed it. Like we scraped together a few trials and demos. We were building animation software back in like 2008 and we had some really cool people try it, but no one ever used it. You know, it never became part of their workflow or part of their life. And that was a huge learning experience for me. And I like to think I applied a lot of those lessons well when we built Lyst. From who we hired to who we talked to, we wanted the fashion industry in the room while we're building that software. And so I think like the biggest thing that makes the difference between like an interesting art project or a cool technology exploration in a business is that a business is built for someone to use, whereas a cool tech idea or like a hobby project is built because you want to build. And both are cool. Both are excellent. Both are good uses of time, you know? I still work a lot on generative art in my free time, and that's just for me. I don't expect anyone to ever need it. But when I'm working on Useful Books, you know, when we're building our beta reading software, every release is shown to customers. Like we get them to tell us why it sucks. And I don't have to take all their advice, but I use that to flavor how we build our roadmaps. And so the biggest piece of advice is if you don't have customer development, you're not doing beta testing, you don't have a customer basically hovering over your shoulder, you're probably building the wrong thing. Sadly, just how it is.
Love it. Love it. And it's clear that with you both, Natasha and Devin, we're going to have a super punchy conversation. And I'm very excited to invite our first guest on the podcast today. We will be hearing from Robinson Nouveau, the founder of SquadPal. So welcome to the podcast, Robinson.
Thank you very much, Marta.
Tell us about SquadPal, what you're building, and also how you came to found it. What problem did you want to solve?
Yeah, SquadPal is basically a social community app where we're trying to help remote teams fight the feeling of isolation and disconnect they have while they're working remotely, right? So, you know, if you think about it, remote workers are most of the day in front of a laptop, in front of a black screen, exchanging with email signatures. So it's not super fun, right? It can get very lonely. So we're trying to help them very much like share personal moment with their teammates through this social community. So we started SquadPal about a year and a half ago now. All three co-founders in SquadPal, we had been remote managers in the past. So dealing with this isolation issue, this disconnect, disengagement issue within our teams. And it's really when COVID hit that we realized maybe there's an opportunity, maybe there's something that we can do here, and maybe we can provide some experience that we have.
Yeah, really, really cool and interesting, because obviously so many of us have been dealing with the issues of remote work for so long now, and we're all asking ourselves what the future will bring for teams. Is it in person? Is it remote? Is it hybrid? So Robinson, super cool business. How can we help today? What's your question?
Yeah, well, I think my first challenge would be around, you know, marketing with a low budget, right? Because in early stage SaaS businesses, you don't necessarily have a lot of a massive budget for marketing, as you generally focus more on product development. And the question really is, how can you prioritize your campaigns, you know, your marketing effort, especially since the impact of those campaigns is really hard to quantify. So, and you know, it feels like everyone is doing guerrilla marketing these days as well. So it's a very competitive market as well. So that's the main challenge.
Thanks, Robinson. Maybe before we jump in, and I'm seeing Dev and Natasha both nod, so lots of wisdom coming your way. Can you tell us a little bit more about the stage of your business? So where is your business right now? Do you have customers? How far are you?
Yep. So we launched publicly last year in February, and we've grown completely organically so far. We haven't done a lot of marketing, so we're going to start the growth efforts in a couple of months. And we already have more than 300 companies with really cool names like Amazon and some others. So we're really excited to have them because, as Devin said, right, for us, we see it as, you know, a way to validate the solution that we're building, because the problem is there. We are very confident about the problem, but now working with those customers really is helping us validate the solution that we're building, right? So for that reason, now we're trying to extend our user base and get more feedback.
Any follow-up questions for Robinson, or any first thoughts?
Yeah, I'm happy to dive in there. This is something that I have experienced firsthand and that comes up a lot. And I guess before you start thinking about campaigns or like starting to funnel money into anything to do with marketing, I always ask people to take a step back, which is actually thinking about, well, what is it that you do that's interesting? Why? Who is it for? What is the position you think that you can uniquely own in the market that you're in? And then how do you bring that to life? And sort of building on what Devin was saying earlier around your customers, and Robinson, it's great to hear that, you know, you've got sort of 300 customers already using SquadPal, and you're involving them very deeply as you think about what you're building product-wise. But how much are you using the language that they're giving you in terms of your marketing activity? And how much are you bringing that to the fore in terms of your messaging on your website or in any campaigns you're building? You'd be amazed, I think, the brand we often think we want to build and the stories we want to tell versus what people actually want us to do for them, there can be a bit of a disconnect. And I think being really focused around the customer first and how you bring that to life through your marketing is key. I think the other thing when you're thinking about starting to build marketing campaigns, look, there is no one golden bullet of marketing that will just last in perpetuity and forever. You have to have a multi-pronged, multi-channel approach. And you also need to be realistic about the budget and the time that you have right now and the sort of results you need. You know, marketing should be moving towards the business goals as a whole and being very clear around, as a business, where is it we need to get to and how does marketing help us achieve that is the key as far as I'm concerned. And then I just think the classic sort of 80-20, you invest sort of 80% of your time into things that are working, and the beauty of being a startup is you then have that 20% for experimentation. And yes, everyone does do some guerrilla activity, but what is the kind of guerrilla fun activity that would be real to you guys at SquadPal and unique and that your customers would love that could then get that flywheel of advocacy kind of spinning and turning even faster for you guys?
How big are you now, Robinson? Sorry if I missed it.
Customer-wise, we're keeping access to the platform limited. So at the moment, we have like 300 companies, and each companies have, you know, a couple of teams, a few teams for some of them. So still a relatively small user base at the moment.
How are they brought on? Is it like a B2B sales process, or how do you get the initial cohort into the app?
So usually it's really like word of mouth from, you know, once you have one team in the company, usually if they're happy with the product, if you're a sales team, you're going to talk about to the marketing team and tell them, hey, like join me on SquadPal. We're going to do like a running challenge or something. So that's really how we're trying to focus our effort on is the network effect within those companies. So that instead of trying to get 1,000 companies, we're trying to get 10, 20 and grow within those companies, because we've realized that the benefits of SquadPal is much bigger if you have a lot of different teams within the same company.
And so it's natural onboarding. There's no sales process. It's just...
There's no sales process at all. No, it's completely organic. When they sign up, they create their team. They don't need us. We like to do demos just because we like talking to customers. It's always good, you know, to see their reaction to the product. So we try to do onboarding as much as we can and do follow-up calls so that we get their feedback live, you know, what they think about the product, what they liked, didn't like.
And so there's no revenue monetization or anything in place?
No.
And what do you think that looks like? This all flavors my answer because stuff matters. Like, how do you want to make money in the future?
It will be subscription-based. So right now, it is only a social community in the sense that, you know, you come in onto SquadPal, you play with your team, you have fun, you share personal moments. But in the future, what we really want to get at is the biggest pain point for companies, which is not necessarily, you know, having access to those platforms, but it's more, what do you do with this engagement? Once you have, you know, people engaged on this tool, how do you measure employee engagement? Because that's what you want to get at, right? The ROI for your solution, how much more your teams are engaged. And so once we're able to give you this employee engagement data, we can also give you recommendations. So for each team in your company, we're going to be able to tell you, okay, we can see that the engagement is pretty low this week, so you should probably do this activity. And that's really why we, you know, our vision is to become a chief happiness officer as a service, so that we can be embedded in all those teams and play this role of a happiness manager, even though it's going to be, you know, virtual. But yeah, we have the data to suggest the best activities for you.
So like in that case, that thank you so much for that complete answer, because that really helps me understand where you're at. You're doing what I would recommend. If your whole thing is social, then that points towards a viral feedback loop, or at least a community feedback loop. And if you want to sort of skip out on the heavy and sometimes very expensive enterprise sales process, like doing this internal growth system is good. I like this product retention-led growth. So I guess the question then is, you know, in early SaaS, I wouldn't worry so much about marketing per se in the terms of like traditional marketing. And I'd be thinking entirely about your growth engine, which is like, what are the activities that cause people to invite new people? What are the scenarios where it jumps from the sales team to the marketing team, or from the marketing team to the engineering team? Or what are things that bring the whole company together to do this thing? If your hypothesis is it should grow naturally inside of a business, set that as your goal. Like if we have one person inside of GitLab using it, right? How long until GitLab uses this as a central piece? And I don't know how you do that, but I think that's like how you start to phrase it. And this is how I think about growth in my own companies. And this is very much like a disclaimer, because I'm really bad at traditional marketing stuff. It's not what I'm good at. I'm good at product-led marketing. So I often reach for that wrench first. And so, yeah. And so I think like, I love your approach. And because you sort of embrace that social approach to growth, like just dig down on it. And then since you're sort of delaying the revenue model, this idea of like, we have a data set that's valuable, the bigger the data set, the more valuable it should be, right? Like that's how it usually works.
Yeah.
So yeah, more experimentation and hacking around like, what are the internal experiences that take a single kernel to 10 kernels? And is that replicable? Or if not, why not?
Yeah, that is our approach at the moment. And I think that's, you know, the challenge going forward is really, how do you turn those? Because you always have this team creator, this person that's lead the charge, download SquadPal, invite their teammates. But the challenge that we really want to fix in a way is to turn those people that join those teams into themselves becoming ambassadors. You have one person, how do you turn those teammates into themselves team creators? And that is the viral element within the product, because then everyone creates their own team for the team that you manage. If you're in a big organization, And yeah, and I think right now that's the focus. So it's a lot of experimentation, but yeah, that's the focus.
Are you seeing any commonalities within the organizations you're selling into? Like, who is the disproportionately influential person within that team that is getting this and is downloading SquadPal and getting their team on board?
Usually the persona for the team creator is either a co-founder, because we have a lot of startup scale-ups, or we have a lot of product managers. Product managers, I feel like, love experimenting new tools. And so these people usually are the one to bring it on board in their company, and then they advocate for it. But those are the main personas that we're seeing at the moment. And so that's where we're focusing our efforts on.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, really understanding, like, what does this person want? Are they looking constantly for new tools and tech to be part of their stack? And I always use the example of something like Notion or Stripe, right? What did Stripe do in the early days? They knew that they were for the developer. So what did they do? They built everything and positioned it around making the developer's life easier. And then the developer could make the business case to get that sold in. Because if you're wanting to move in towards a subscription model, somebody is going to have to sign off on that budget, right? And, you know, even hearing you speak in response to Devin's question, when you talked about this idea of in time being the chief happiness officer, which wasn't how you initially framed what it is you're out to do. And if you zoom out a little bit and think about one of the huge issues we've got in the market at the moment, which is around retaining great talent, well, surely something that teams could be integrating as a way to keep people and retain their people is something that becomes really compelling. So I guess I would be taking a lot of these pieces and actually trying to put them together in terms of the framing and how you're potentially selling it in to help build that advocacy as well.
And I think the only thing that comes to mind to add on the point that we discussed, which is these are these sort of proactive product managers, co-founders who like to experiment with new tools. What can you do that would deter them from trying out a tool coming from a competitor? How can you lock them in and make them feel like they're better off investing more in using this product better rather than seeing if there's anything else out there that might work for them better? Are you thinking about that already?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, the topic of this podcast is chasing hype. There's a lot of hype in the remote market at the moment. There are, you know, other solutions similar to us trying to fix the same problem, but just with a different approach, right? And for us, the way we're trying to essentially position ourselves is to focus on a big niche, right? These remote workers. You have other solutions for flexible teams. You have other solutions for people working out of the office 2 days a week, etc. What we really want to focus on is the remote population. Why? Because these guys face a tougher challenge when it comes to isolation, disconnect from teams. It is something that they feel every day. So since we know that this is our target market, now we're focusing all of our effort into the usability of the app for these people. For example, we've decided to kill every live activity that we had on the platform. That was an experiment that we ran because we realized that people remote, they don't like to stay on at 4 o'clock on a Friday to play a quiz on Zoom. They like the flexibility. In their core, they like having flexible schedules. So that's why our activities are completely asynchronous to really fit within their schedule whenever they want to play. And it's very appealing to this population. And the second element that we're trying to embed into the app is the gamification, right? Everything that you do needs to be extremely fun, needs to be extremely engaging, because, you know, it's probably like the first interface that you're going to have with your teammates. So might as well, you know, have lots of colorful animations on your screen, make it really playful in a way. So those are two main elements that we have compared to a lot of competition out there.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Robinson, for joining us. Amazing story of what you're building. How do we find you and your business online? How can we learn more?
Yep. You can find SquadPal on mobile, so App Store, Play Store, but you can also find SquadPal on Slack with our integration. So it's completely integrated within your workplace.
Fabulous. Thanks so much. Really, really enjoyed this. And if we thought that remote working was the biggest hype recently? Well, let's see, because there is at least one more industry that everybody seems to be talking about, and it's this sort of intersection of Web3, Metaverse, AR, VR. So we're delighted to be joined by Josh Parfit from Portal. Thanks so much for joining us on Scale Ups and Downs. Josh, tell us about your business. What does Portal do? How did you come to found it?
So I'm Josh Parfit, founder of Portal Group, and we are helping Web3 gaming industry unlock the huge potential of integrating music artists onto their platforms. So by developing immersive experiences in entirely digital worlds. Last year, over 3.2 billion people played some form of video game, which hints at the huge potential of the industry. So we consider these digital spaces a new form of social platform. Portal has begun to host events in early stage metaverses, and continues to develop experiences to rival the Super Bowl's halftime show.
Really, really cool. You're saying all of the words that are just adding zeros to the valuation in my head. So I'm super excited to have you on the podcast. What's your question, Josh? How can we help? And also, I suppose, maybe even before we get to the question, I'd love to understand a little bit more about the stage of your business. How long have you been around? Where are you based? What's the story so far?
Yeah, for sure. So we're based in Cardiff. We're currently pre-seed. So very early, we've built out our MVP and we're essentially just in product testing stage, just testing out there, building a bit of a networking community around it so we can test our iterations. And yeah, that's about where we are.
Awesome. And how can we help today?
Sure. So I'm very aware that the Web3 space is very early doors, likened to building the internet in the early 90s. So I would love to know your guys' thoughts on the best practice to differentiate myself from competition and how to tell a compelling product story when building a startup in such a hot sector.
My answer for this is really simple, which is don't worry about it. Like if you worry about that, then you're playing your competitor's game, right? Because the reason it's hyped is that people are talking about stuff, they're working on things, they're launching new things. I mean, obviously, be aware. Like, be aware of your surroundings. Like, when you're driving a car, you're not like staring at the McDonald's sign being like, how did they extrude that plastic? No, you know it's there, right? And you know it exists. But you're focused on what you're doing, which is driving the car. And so it seems a bit counterintuitive, but the best way to succeed in a busy space is to get people to use your stuff. It's to make improvements. It's to build your vision. And I think one of the most disastrous things you can do is start to really try to play the game that your competitors are playing. And the reason is I say that is because you don't know why they're doing that. They could be doing it for all the wrong reasons. I'll give you a story from my second business, Lyst, where I fell for this trap. So Lyst, for those who don't know, is a large social commerce site where we work with high fashion brands to sell high fashion goods online. Not a new thing today, but back when we started the business in 2010, no one was selling high fashion goods online. There were lots of sites who curated high fashion goods like Polyvore and Hypebeast and stuff like that. And we noticed that a lot of our competitors who weren't selling things, but they were doing like the curation social mag thing, they did lots of mood boards. Like that was the new feature. Everyone could drag images in and create mood boards, then paste that to Pinterest or share that to Twitter or to Facebook or whatever. And I was like, oh, we need this feature. Of course, everyone loves these features. Let's build it. So we built it. I built it over with my engineering team over like a couple of weeks and launched it. And nothing changed. Like if anything, our sales went down because people were spending time building mood boards. And the problem was, is like we weren't a social magazine company, we were an e-commerce platform. And because we sort of got absorbed in the hype and I was like, I'm going to build this feature, what I effectively did was I slowed down our e-commerce side of our business, sped up a social mag business, which didn't exist. It wasn't part of our strategy. And it was a good experiment and thankfully only wasted effectively like 2 months of engineering time. And like, I guess on one hand, we knew it was a bad idea now because we did it. But like, we didn't play our game. We had a pretty strong game, which was like, no one's selling the stuff online, we should sell it. Everyone's talking about it, but no one's selling it. And that was where Lyst really shone. We built great commerce engines. We had the business connections, do all the logistics in the back end, right? The way you become hyped is because you've built something people are excited about. And so you focus on building what you think is interesting, obviously flavored with like input from trying it and testing it and showing it around. And I'd actually argue even like building in public as much as possible. That's like the cheapest way to do it. A lot of people won't care until they do. That's like the annoying thing about it. But yeah, that's it. I think the way you fight the hype is you're aware of it, but you don't play that game. I think you've all seen those cringy NFT projects where it's like board, monkey, boat club. And you're like, oh, you're just trying to ride in the coattails and everyone knows it's bad. Like everyone knows it's bad. Like no one thinks this is cool. So like that's not what you do. You do something you think is interesting based on your experiences and your research and your customer development, and then you see what happens. And then that's how you pull ahead.
Yeah, for sure.
I think to build on that, you know, you're at pre-seed, right? I think focus is so critical, and the temptation to get caught up in this hype cycle and just constantly be launching new products and features rather than actually focusing on building something that creates an exceptional experience that people then want to talk about, which then helps shape your story and your positioning around what people should be coming to you for. I see it time and time again. And, you know, from Devin's example, like, people want to build so much because what they have built is clearly not working or compelling enough. And you can end up distracting yourselves and wasting so much time to just sort of rip it up and bin this stuff off. And experimentation is great, but I think focus on the product that you can realistically build as a pre-seed company in the here and now, and being honest about, is it working? Is it resonating? When we're talking to people about this, are they getting it? Are they excited by it? As well as how are we thinking about the difference between what is a product story and what is a vision? Because a vision and where we want to get to is something that we need to have. That's how we get people to join our team. It's how we raise investment. It's how we get people excited about the long-term journey that we're going on. Whereas the product is how we bridge the chasm of how we get there. And that's always going to be evolving. And so taking people on that journey with you, but never losing sight and having clearly articulated what that longer-term vision we want to get ourselves towards is as well.
Yeah, for sure. That's exactly what I'm finding with our product iteration at the minute as well. Obviously, we want to be working with games being developed in the Web3 space. So we're taking the opportunity to get hold of these games early doors and get into their Discord channels so we can host a couple parties, get some events thrown in there so we can pick up on what their customers are saying. We're finding a lot would be considered our competitors. They're spending fortunes on doing this type of product or releasing this service. But what we're finding is like, that's not actually what the people want. And so it's good to hear from you guys that just knuckle down and concentrate on what we're doing and what we're best at.
And just to clarify, it's knuckle down, but it's knuckle down with like a very short-term goal in mind, right? It's like in the next couple of weeks, let's try this and see if that improves what we understand of our space or gets people to use it, right? I think the hardest thing to do, especially in these interactive spaces where you're depending on people to come and use you and bring this value, is like, how do we provide to them and see the value sort of play out, no matter how duct taped or hamstrung together it is? Like, it's like, see that value chain being created. Like, you have to fake it, right? Like in the early stages of Useful Books, we faked so much of what our software did just because we wanted to make sure like it was worth building, because engineering takes time, right? And is super error prone. So yeah, just knuckle down, but don't knuckle down and disappear for a year, right? keep that like touching reality cycle really, really tight, like weekly.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome, Josh. Is raising venture a path that you want to go down? Because you may be meeting just the right people for it.
Yeah, we like Web3. We've invested in a few co's.
Yeah, absolutely. So we will be looking at raising soon. Our primary focus is to get a bit more traction at the minute. We want to make sure that we really understand our customer base and make sure that the service that we're offering the games is exactly what they want, where they're going with it. And once we've got that traction, then we'll be throwing everything we've got at it and hopefully bringing in a couple of you guys along with us, of course.
Fabulous. Thanks so much, Josh. So how do we find more about Portal? Can we try the product? I'm not a gamer, so please handhold me through that. How do I learn more about Portal?
We are working with games. I can't say what they are just yet. However, I did get off a phone call this morning with one of the most anticipated games coming this year, who have been in talks with Snoop Dogg and Fisher about hosting events in their arena. And then, so keep your ear to the ground and hopefully you'll be seeing us throwing a couple of parties in there soon.
Sounds fabulous. And can I just say, this is not a podcast today on fundraising. It's a podcast on succeeding in a hyped up market. But Josh has just performed something that is exactly the right thing to do. A little bit of FOMO. It's coming down, but you can't exactly see it. And I can't tell you who I'm talking to, but it's going to be awesome. Well done, man.
Wait for the investor inbound to pour in after this.
And then, you know, just remember, Seedcamp, we're there first. No, awesome. Josh, thank you so much for joining us on Scale Ups and Downs. This has been brilliant. And Devon, Natasha, you are just fantastic. So before I let you go, I want to make sure that I get a couple of quick bits of insight from you. I'm really keen. You're obviously keeping yourself super well informed. What are you reading recently? Who are you following on Twitter? Are there any podcasts maybe you're listening to that our listeners should check out?
So I'm definitely not following VC Twitter because it does make me want to shoot myself in the head a little bit. I'm actually trying to be honest, like broaden my listening and a lot of my reading outside of the immediacy of what I do every day. I think for inspiring creativity, it's really important. I've been thinking a lot about psychology, what that means for how we build teams, understanding people's needs when they're coming to us, be that a founder looking for investment or somebody looking for a role. Been listening to stuff around relationships as well. Everybody speaks about Esther Perel, but she's got a podcast around relationships with people at work. So that's something I've been listening to, especially when you think about how we navigate moving from having done so much in person to now managing relationships online. So probably very relevant for you, Robinson. That would be a recommendation from me.
Really awesome. Actually advocating for being a well-rounded individual rather than just being stuck in the tech world. Crazy idea. And Devon.
So it's a well-timed question because I've sort of in the last 6 months made a transition from being the high-level operator back to building a new company. And so some things get rusty. You forget. You sort of get overconfident in your abilities. And I know one book that was recommended to me is this book by Kathy Sierra called Badass, Making Users Awesome. It just sort of paints a picture of how to think about from the user perspective of like, are you making them like a superhero in your app? Or are you just hamstringing them with normal UI conventions and normal business conventions and things like that? And it was a good wake-up call because, you know, you read it and you go, oh yeah, I'm doing this. Crap. And it's just a nice sort of checklist to make sure you're not creating crappy stuff by accident. And so Badass, Making Users Awesome was a really good book I read recently.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And I just love so much that we discussed today, starting from the fact that I think if I was to boil it down to Devon's point that maybe, you know, can we get 80% of insight in 20% of the time? Double down on the value that your user is clearly communicating to you is critical. But there is also an element of confidence. With confidence as founders, that you're building the right thing, that you're the right person for the job, and consistency and execution. It's hugely relevant and really, really helpful to, I'm sure, everybody that is listening to this. But I also love this point of actually to be good at what we do, to stay well-rounded and well-informed. Also, Natasha, thanks for that plug for psychology. I'm actually a psychologist by education, which I really thought for the better part of my career was this random degree that I just sort of picked up while building my first startup, and I thought it'd be relevant. But I really love how we're increasingly leaning into incredibly important social skills, soft skills, and how that lends itself to us being able to operate well in the world. And I suppose work is a function of that. So I'm so delighted and grateful that you all joined us today, Robinson, Josh, Natasha, and Devon. And if you've enjoyed listening to this, founders out there, it could be you on the next podcast asking questions to our expert panel. If you wanted to do that, you need to go to scaleupsanddowns.com and submit a scale-up question. It can be anything. Think product, marketing, growth, tech, security, fundraising. We'd love to hear what's front of your mind. This is supposed to be for you and by you and with you. So we'd love to have you on Scale Ups and Downs. And for now, thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much, founders and experts. Have a fabulous day. I hear you next time.